Hello, everybody. This is Steve from the Diecast Movie Podcast. Hope everybody's having a good day. In today's episode, I'm going to be talking with Bob Fermanek, who did the restoration for the 70th anniversary Blu-ray for Robot Monster. He's also going to be a guest at the Monster Bash this October 13th through the 15th, 2023. So I hope everybody gets to come to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and gets to meet him and Gregory Moffat and a lot of the other people that are going to be there that Ron and I talked about in our episode two episodes ago. Just before we start talking about the movie, I just want to play the trailer. You'll hear the audio version of Robot Monster's trailer. And then as soon as that's done, Bob and I will start right into the movie. Hope everybody has a good day and enjoy the episode.
With the swiftness of a deadly cosmic ray, the Earth is invaded by indestructible moon monsters. Their ghastly mission, death for all humans. What astounding technical developments are being made to protect mankind? Robot Monster brings you an actual preview of the devastating forces of our future. Unsuspected revelations of incredible horrors that will terrify you with their brutal reality.
There is no escape from me. Very well. I will recalculate. Your death will be indescribable. Fool humans, there is no escape.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Diecast Movie Podcast, where normally the movies we discuss are decided by a roll of a die, but today I decided to go a little different. As you know from the last episode, I was able to talk to Gregory Moffat, the star of Robot Monster, and I thought, what better thing to have than the person who helped restore this charming movie from 70 years ago and bring it back on Blu-ray, bring it back so we can see it in 3D with the Blu-ray having a bunch, I mean a bunch of extras. The one and only Bob Fermanek. How you doing today, Bob?
Well, hello, Stephen. I'm doing very well. Thank you. And it's a pleasure to be here on your show.
I'm glad to have you on the show. And I know we're going to be meeting each other in person. We're doing this on Zoom right now, ladies, so we're able to see each other. But we're going to meet each other in person at Monster Bash this October 13th through the 15th, 2023, up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Are you excited?
Oh, I've been wanting to go to Monster Bash for many, many years, and this is finally going to happen. It's my first opportunity to go there, and I love what they do and the fact that they're, you know, doing shows that are family friendly, and going to be driving in with a couple of wonderful friends in the area, the Madaskas, a 14-year-old and an 8-year-old and their dad. And these are monster kids, just like we were growing up. And I can't wait. It's going to be a lot of fun.
I'm sure it's going to be a fun car trip to and from, because you'll be telling them what, oh, this is what's going to be happening. You're going to enjoy it. And then back, you'll get to hear how much fun they did have, because this is, as Ron and I talked about a couple episodes ago, a very family-friendly convention. They're going to have a chance to have, I don't know if they like it, but they're going to have tacos. They're going to have Mexican Monster Movie Night. On Saturday morning, they have breakfast. They give out little cereal boxes and have cartoons in the morning. And then also on Saturday night, they have cake. They just give cake. So things that children love, I'm sure, tacos and things with sugar.
Never mind children. I love it. I can't wait.
A lot of people can't, and I think they're going to have a good time. And one of the things that's going to be showing on Saturday night, if I remember the schedule correctly, probably the feature time frame, is Robot Monster in 3D. And listeners, you can't see this, but I'm putting my glasses on, you know, that way we can just, you know, you can just picture Ron's going to be providing everybody the glasses so people will be able to see the movie the way it was meant to be seen.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a lot of fun. And, you know, one of the things about Robot Monster, the restoration, and all of the restorations that we're doing now, we're actually preparing two different versions of the film in 3D. All of the films of the 50s were originally shown in a very high-quality polarized 3D presentation, which used Polaroid glasses, very similar to what you would get in theaters today with a Real D presentation. But for the people that don't have that kind of equipment at home, we're also creating the red and cyan anaglyphic version. Greg Kintz, our technical director out of Indiana, has developed a really advanced technique for encoding these films in the anaglyphic 3D, which is far superior to what people have seen before. And one of the things about Robot Monster and why we were so anxious to restore it is it did not have a good reputation in terms of its 3D work. And that was largely due to the fact that Medallion Television, which owned the rights in the 70s through the 90s, they created an anaglyphic 3D version for use back on television in the 80s, but they didn't have complete 3D elements. So whole sections of the film went flat. And for years, the theory was that, well, Robot Monster was such a low budget movie that they couldn't afford a 3D camera for every day. So yes, originally a lot of the film was flat. And that's simply not true, except for the few stock shots in the film from 1 Million BC and Lost Continent and some other flat movies. Everything is fully stereoscopic. The new Blu-ray restoration that we've done restores the 3D to what would have been seen in theaters 70 years ago.
And I know I'm a monster kid, and people are going to be upset when they hear this, but not everybody sees every film all the time, and there's a lot of movies out there I still haven't seen. But I've watched your Blu-ray, and it was the first time for me seeing the movie. So I was able to see it for the first time in 3D at home, and I love... People can say when they watch 3D, they like the things that stick out at you or the bubbles coming out. What I like is the depth that you can see with the actors when you, for instance, when they're in the house, their shelter area, which had the ceiling off and the walls are crumbled, and you can see people coming towards them. You get that nice, you know, period of depth where you can see people walking. So it's not like if you're watching on 2D where they're really close to each other, you can get that feeling of space. And so as you said, it's throughout the movie except for those elements which are obviously stock footage, and it really shows well, and it worked well.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that the natural depth that the film contains from all, you know, everything was shot outside. It was entirely done on location in either Bronson Canyon or Chavez Ravine. And you've got that natural outdoor depth that you would see in if you were there in person. And that really works to the film's advantage. One of the reasons that the film does not have a lot of kind of 3D gimmick shots of things, projecting out into the audience or thrown at the camera is the fact that those took a lot of time to set up. And Robot Monster was shot in 4 days. It was actually originally scheduled for a 3-day shoot, but they added a fourth day when Phil Tucker, the director, got a hold of the automatic billion bubble machine. They decided to reshoot some of the shots of Roman coming out of the cave with this bubble machine. And that's one of the nice 3D gimmicks in the film, because you've got these bubbles coming off the screen. But the film is, you know, really comparable to anything that any of the major studios did in 3D in 1953. And I think a lot of people will really be surprised with that. For 4 days of filming and a budget of $16,000, they did an outstanding job. The 3D is very, very well done.
I agree with you. And I never would have known. So I'm glad for my first viewing, I got to see it the way it was meant to be seen. And I think it really enhances it. And I enjoyed, I mean, I've seen like different small, like short little segments. They'll show up in different film clips. So I knew what some things roughly look like. And I did a little comparison with looking at an old, like some stuff that's on YouTube, you know, people having some footage from the older days to see how the restoration really made it so much, you know, more enhanced. And you could just see the love put into it. And as I say, this was like a long time for you working because trying to find the different prints out there. So it was almost like a little Indiana Jones type things on your part or your team's part going out there and trying to find these elements.
Oh yeah. It was an uphill battle to say the least. Normally we will get through a vintage 3D feature restoration in about 3 months. And Robot Monster was on the operating table for just about a year. We had a lot of damage on the elements. It was almost a textbook example of what, you know, what could go wrong with restoring a vintage movie. We had water damage on the material. We had a vinegar syndrome where the, you know, the print is deteriorating, and it was different between the left and right sides. There were so many things that we had to fight. It was really an uphill battle in making this film look the very best it could. But again, Greg Kintz, with his incredible skills with restoring vintage 3D, he was able to, you know, make everything work. People are kind of knocked out with the quality of it. And that's a great feeling.
I'm just glad you were able to find it, the elements, get it restored in time for its 70th anniversary, because obviously that was, I know for your end, for marketing, you want to hit a big anniversary for, or a big time thing for a film, and 70 is such a nice round number. You know, you want to make sure you can get it out and get it done. In that, what was your experiences? When did you first see Robot Monster, and how did you learn to appreciate the film?
Well, I saw it as a kid. You know, I'm 62 years old, so I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and the film was pretty widely seen on TV here in the New York market. So, you know, like a lot of monster kids from my generation, that was our first exposure. I didn't see it in 3D, though. Well, I had gotten the medallion version that came out in the 80s, and like everyone else, I was pretty disappointed with it. But in 1990, when I really began my efforts to try to save and restore as much vintage 3D as possible, I found two 35mm prints at a film storage depot here in New Jersey, and it turned out to be a left and right pair. For the 3D at that time, they were shown on two 35mm prints, a left eye and a right eye. And those had to be interlocked and shown on two projectors. And so when I found these two prints, they needed a lot of work to recombine and make sure that they were in perfect synchronization. And when I finally got that done, I didn't have a screening room yet set up for 3D. So I'd gone into New York City and ran it at a venue there. And I was knocked out with how good it looked in 3D. You know, I realized at that time, this was now 33 years ago, that there's a good quality 3D movie here, and I wanted more people to see it the way that it was intended to be seen. So it's taken a long time, but was definitely worth the effort. And I think for the 70th anniversary, and for Greg Moffitt, who's one of the nicest people you'll ever meet, it was nice to see this all come together.
And I want to thank Greg again, because he was the one who suggested, when I asked him about interviewing him and I talked, and he said, oh, what about Bob? You want to talk to Bob? He knows all the ins and outs of making restoration. And I'm like, sure. And he helped set it all up. So again, thank you, Greg, you know, for helping this happen. But yeah, I've met him on the virtually, and then on, you know, and that kind of stuff, and over the phone. I've yet to see him like either Zoom or in person, but that'll be all rectified at Monster Bash. But he just, what a nice guy, because he doesn't know me from anybody, and here I reach out to him. Do you want to do an interview? And he's like, oh, what about this person? And you know, we can do that and that. And I was like, wow, you know, it was such a nice person to be able to help somebody out that he doesn't even know really.
I agree 100%. And anybody that comes to the convention will have an opportunity to meet Greg. He'll have a table. You know, you'll get a chance to get your picture taken with him and autographs. He's such a wonderful guy. So, yeah, I think people going to Monster Bash are in for a real treat.
And also, you'll be introducing the film, and I think you and Greg will be doing a Q&A after the screening of Robot Monster, if I'm correct.
Yes, that's the plan. We're going to do a short introduction just to kind of set the stage and then come back afterwards. And that's always a lot of fun because getting an opportunity to interact and get the questions from, you know, from people after they've seen the movie is always interesting. I love doing it. So that's going to be, I'm really looking forward to that.
I am too. And I'm sure a lot of the people going are, I mean, it's the feature presentation, like I said, for the convention. I mean, Ron's even made t-shirts up with Roman on it and all that kind of stuff for this year's bash or this October's bash to go through.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Ron knows how to, he knows how to put on a good show. That's for sure.
Now, one of the things is with the movie, and again, this was my first time seeing it. It's a short movie. It's just like, what, 66 minutes? It's something. It's just over an hour.
Yes.
And it really moves along in some aspects because it has a short running time. Though, as movies of that elk, being that it was low budget, there are some things where things are being repeated, as with stock footage, or some scenes are being repeated, like with Roman doing his stuff with the machinery, you know, the mechanisms, where you can tell it's the same shot over and over because everything ends up being re-put back the way it was before after he's moved it. Yes, those things happen because they're trying to pad the running time. But otherwise, I thought it was nice about how when he went into the dream sequence, all the costumes changed, everything changed, the relationships changed, and you knew right away this is not reality. If you're paying attention, you're right off the bat, you know, and then you go through most of the movie is in the dream. And I thought that was pretty nicely done, how they changed the outfit, because it's a small cast of six people and, or seven, you know, if you count Roman, seven. And it's just, you have a small group going through the whole film. And what did you think when you were watching the film when you were younger and now?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I don't want to give too much away for those who maybe have not seen the film yet, but once you know the premise and know that as you mentioned, you've got a dream angle to it. A lot of the weird stuff in the film kind of makes sense. Plus, it's a dream or a nightmare for a 10-year-old science fiction crazy boy, and all logic goes out the window there. You know, I met around 2003, we had a screening of the 35mm prints at the World 3D Film Expo in Hollywood, and Phil Tucker Jr. came to the show, the super nice guy, and he had never seen it in 3D before, and he told me afterwards that, you know, his dad intended the film to be from the point of view of a child, a child's nightmare. I think he succeeded. The whole film has this reputation for being so schlocky, but I think if you understand what Tucker was trying to achieve with the plot and the characters and everything, suddenly a lot of the weirdness sort of makes sense. And it's going to be interesting to see how it plays at the Monster Bash. I'm looking forward to seeing that with the audience.
Well, I think it's going to be a big hit because one, I think, at least half the people, probably 70% of the people would have seen it already before, and there's going to be those people like myself who just seen it, would be seeing it for the first time or just seen it once recently. And I'm looking forward to seeing it on the bigger screen, you know, cause I got to see it on TV. So I'm thinking, okay, now I know what it's like to see it on TV. I know I can't wait to see it there. And my older son is going to be with me. He's in his early 20s. And I'm not sure if he's going to watch the film prior or if he's going to be seeing it for the first time there. So I'm curious to get his perspective, you know, because here you get somebody in their 20s. And it's like, what do you think? How did the film hold up with you? And I mean, there's some parts, like we said, there's some stock footage and some parts that repeat. But overall, it's a nice story. And it really, it even has a theme of one of those, like, learning the lessons. Because Johnny, the boy, learns a lesson in it during the dream about how to, with his sister, always wanting to spend time playing house. And then during the dream, he learns that he should spend more time with her. And that kind of stuff. And it's just, I think it applies to real life where a lot of people are always focused on doing their thing and then they forget about the people around them. And it, so it has, it's a message movie.
No, absolutely. Well, I can tell you that we've had a couple of screenings of the restoration now in New York City at the Dolby screening room on the 70th anniversary of the world premiere. And also recently at the Film Forum. We've attracted a lot of younger people. The film's got such a reputation that the demographics that come to the screenings are, you know, the age ranges are all over the map. And we had quite a few college age people attend, and they loved it. You know, the word of mouth and the comments I got after the film were all very positive. I think people will be very surprised to, you know, see the film. And one of the nice things about restoring the title like this is, and bringing it back to pristine condition, is you don't have to look at it through this, you know, filter of seeing a washed out or beat up print. And you know, let's face it, the versions of Robot Monster that have been shown over the last 4 or 5 decades have not really been that clean. So I think having it restored adds, you know, a whole new luster to the film. And for us and the team that worked on the restoration, it's really wonderful to see it kind of get reappraised and find new audiences.
One thing I wanted to ask you, and this might sound like a stupid question, but being that I've never seen the movie before, the opening title sequence of the restored version, is that the original opening title with the comic books and the actors in the like oval part? Or is that something you guys did?
No. When we do a restoration, we aim to present the film as you would have seen it in a theater when it was brand new. So our Robot Monster presentation includes the original prologue, Stardust in Your Eyes, with comedian Slick Slavin. And the title sequence is exactly what audiences saw in theaters in 1953. And even to take that one step further, we have restored the original intermission point to the movie. Every 3D movie shown in the 1950s had a built-in intermission because of the technical limitations and projection booths at the time. They had to change reels. They weren't able to have more than 50 minutes on a reel at one time. So for the restoration, people now are hearing Elmer Bernstein's original music cue at the intermission point, which hasn't been heard anywhere in 7 decades. This restoration is pretty much what you would have seen if you paid your 85 cents and went to the movies in 1953.
I'm glad you explained it, because when that intermission came up, I'm like, this movie is only a little over an hour. Why is there an intermission? Now I understand why. Because it just blew me when this intermission came up. I said, this isn't like Ben-Hur or the Ten Commandments where it's going to go on and you need an intermission for people to hit the snack stand and use the facilities. You know, this is a quicker version of the movie, a quicker movie because of the time. But the opening credits, I'm glad you said it was done by Phil Tucker, and they're amazing. They were one of the best opening credits I've seen for a 3D film going into it, because with the way the comic books were layered, with the people in the middle of the screen, I mean, it really utilized the technology well. I thought it was well thought out and better than most movies that are 3D opening title sequence that I've seen.
I agree. It gets your attention right out of the gate when we've screened it publicly. It's always a lot of fun to stand in the back and gauge the audience response, because there's an audible gasp to the film when it first comes on screen, because you've got those 6 or 7 layers of depth with the comic books and titles. And it's, you know, nobody has seen it that way in 70 years. That section was flat on the medallion version that was done in the 70s. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. We're incredibly happy with the reception it's getting.
And before we talk about the bonus features and stuff like that, do you want to talk a little bit about some of the actors that are in the movie besides Gregory Moffitt, who we talked about a little bit, you know, from, you know, when you were watching, like, which, how did you like their interactions, or did you have a favorite scene with them?
Well, I think the actors, you know, these were all professionals. I think they did a very good job with it. You know, I think the interactions are very interesting in terms of the characters. And, you know, George Nader was kind of an up-and-coming star at the time. Shortly after doing Robot Monster, he got a contract with Universal International and appeared in some pretty big-budget movies. But, you know, the script and the dialogue may not be on a real high end level, but I think they do a good job with delivering it. It works.
I'll say that he definitely, George Nader got the beefcake role, you know, cause he gets to take his shirt off and show all that stuff. And then, as the movie progresses, you have him and the one lady having, their relationship. I think it's a Claudia Barrett, you know, having a relationship, and they tackle, a lot of people always say about the 50s, oh, you know, the woman can't do this or that or whatever. And they tackle that issue head on, you know, because she's like, oh, we can do that. And that's all through the movie about how they're going back and forward about what she can do and what she can't do. And so I thought that was, hit, you know, for a 1953 movie, that's something you don't really see too often being addressed throughout the movie.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, she's very competent and you know, it kind of saves the day in a way with her technical skills in the movie. So, yeah, I agree with you. That is a very unique aspect to the movie.
Now, Roman, whatever, you know, depending on how people pronounce it, it's such a charming design for a creature. I think because of the way it looks, it's held up for 70 years, where people see it, they know right away, because it's so bizarre of a combination that I think it reminds me, it's like the two-footed version of the giant claw, where you can look at it and say, oh my God, that looks terrible or whatever. Or you can look at it and say, no, that's something you're always going to remember. And it has a certain charm and character to it, quality. What do you think of that, of Roman?
Oh, well, I mean, you've got George Barrows, who plays the part. He was one of the top actors at the time playing gorillas in movies. There were several of them, but he had a very well-designed and realistic gorilla suit. And I think Phil Tucker's call to remove the gorilla head and replace it with that helmet and then put a couple of antenna on top was brilliant. I mean, it's bizarre, but it's certainly very memorable. You know, it's there's merchandising on it that is still happening to this day. It's a very, very unique. And you know, kudos to George Barrows, because I don't know what he was paid for his work on the film, but whatever it is, it wasn't enough, because he's going up and down these hills in Bronson Canyon in that suit. You know, I know Greg remembered that when they would, you know, be between takes and he would take that helmet off, he was just absolutely pouring with sweat. He really earned his paycheck on that film.
Makes me wonder what that gorilla suit probably smelled like at the end of the shoot. You know, it's just one of those things. I can imagine it, you know, not being something you really want to wear for long, but you had to anyway.
No, I'm sure the cleaners had to do a little extra work on getting that one ready for the next film. But yeah, no, it's again on a 4-day shoot with a budget of $16,000. The creature design and execution is pretty clever.
Now, get into what you got with the Blu-ray. I have to say, when listeners, when you're there, you get a chance to pick it up or whatever. The cover that you have on the Blu-ray is just beautiful artwork, you know, showing off Roman, showing off Johnny and some dinosaurs in the background. So sci-fi, like, can you talk about the cover art?
Well, we wanted to do something unique for the cover of this restoration. And there's a wonderfully talented artist named Stuart McKissick out in Ohio who's done about four or five covers for us now on our releases. That's an entirely original piece of art that Stuart did. And I think he knocked it out of the park. It's a beautiful cover. You know, there's a lot of people that like the original 1953 art as well. And that's one of the reasons after the feature, we've got a 3-minute photo gallery cut to music, actually a new song composed for this release. We have all the original artwork in a post feature credit. So you've got the best of both worlds. You've got a brand new illustration for the disc release, and you've got the original art as a follow up to the feature.
And I know earlier you brought it up, Stardust in Your Eyes plays right before the movie. And you said that's the way it played when it was out there for real. How hard was it for you to find that?
Oh, that's a whole other story. The very short version is I found it at an abandoned film lab in Hollywood in the mid-80s. I was working for Jerry Lewis and getting access to a lot of storage facilities. It took years, but we tracked down the comedian who played the part of Slick Slavin in that short. And there's a whole new short documentary about that on this disc called Saving Slick. That tells the story of finding the film and then finding Slick Slavin, how he sort of embraced that discovery in his later years. And it's a very kind of heartwarming story. And a couple years ago, I met and became friends with a couple of very, very talented young filmmakers, Sean Thrunk and Josh Carmona. They did that interview and cut together that short documentary. And I think people really, really enjoyed the story. It's one of the bonus features on the disc.
And there's a ton of bonus features, but I enjoyed watching the original thing, the original opening to the movie, so to speak, or the opening feature or whatever, as a time capsule for what was funny or humorous for early 1950s, because he's doing his imitations, he's doing the other things, and you know, and it kind of gives you the idea, okay, this is what 70 years ago people were expecting normally to see from a comedian going out there to do his act and that kind of stuff. So I like that because it's preserved. There you go, there you can see it. And I think that's what's cool about it being still kept with the movie, so people can watch it again and get that idea what was humorous at that time.
Yeah, well, he was a very popular nightclub comic. I mean, he was not on the A circuit in that he wasn't playing places like the Copacabana in New York or Ciro's in Los Angeles, but he was working the better hotels and you know, the better rooms at the time. A very funny guy. And in fact, one of the interesting things about the film is it was done in one take outdoors. And at one point, obviously unexpected, a plane flies overhead and you can see Trustin kind of look off camera and probably Phil Tucker was there and he said, just keep going, you know, and he stumbles a little bit, but he gets right back into it and goes into his song. And when we played that for an audience today, it still goes over well. His impersonations are very good. Even if you don't know all of the actors that he's doing, I mean, you know, some of them, I mean, everybody knows Humphrey Bogart or James Cagney, but I don't know how many people will remember a few of the others that he does in his act. But it gets a lot of laughs, and it's a big hit with audiences today.
Oh, I agree, and I'm glad you kept it in there. And what I also loved about the bonus features is that you have 2D versions and 3D versions. So it's like, you have ones that go on where you have to still keep wearing your glasses in order to enjoy and get the thrill out of them. And what was, you know, was that the idea to have more 3D in on the disc so people can have more use of, of the glasses and things like that? Was that the idea, or tried to showing different things that were going on with the technology?
Well, we always try when we can to include bonus content. Now, a lot of the restorations we do, and since 2014, we've restored over 30 of vintage 3D films. A lot of those, it's a work for hire arrangement, usually with Kino Lorber. So we don't have an opportunity to include bonus extras. But Robot Monster, it was a complete 3D film archive production. And, you know, we successfully launched it via Kickstarter. We had an enormously successful campaign with over 1,100 backers that pledged to help restore Robot Monster. And we wanted to give them, you know, a good amount of bonus content. Some of the things that we're really proud to have on there, there's a fantastic stereo slide presentation from Hilary Hess called Travels Through Time and Space. And it's basically a collection of homemade stereo photographs ranging from the 1940s until the 1980s. And Hilary does a voiceover on that. That's a very popular bonus. We've got a restored 3D comic book from 1953 called Adventures in 3D. And we worked on that with Carl Scheckel of Carl's Comics, a really, really talented young man who's doing some great work in the comic book field. You know, there's a couple 3D shorts from 1953 that have a little bit of a bubble connection to the film. In terms of some of the flat bonus extras, I think Monster fans will enjoy the restoration we did of Bela Lugosi on You Asked For It in the summer of 1953, where he does his magic act and talks a little bit afterwards about a 3D movie that he was going to be doing called The Phantom Ghoul that unfortunately never got made. But we've restored that from an original 16mm kinescope, and it looks better than anyone has seen that before. There's also a collection of trailers for 3D movies that were playing in Los Angeles in the summer of 1953 when Robot Monster premiered. So there's a good amount of you know, bonus content, both flat and 3D. I think people really get their money's worth on this disc.
Oh, they do. And that was one of the things I was going to bring up was the Bela Lugosi one, because, you know, fans at Monster Bash, obviously Lugosi is one of the Mount Rushmore type icons, you know, from that age of classic movies. And here you are, you have something that you've probably never, ever seen. And it's only available on the disc, you know. So if you want to see it in a nice, beautiful rendition, this is the way to go. So if it wasn't enough to just get Robot Monster, now you get more Bela.
Well, the Lugosi, you asked for it, it's been floating around for decades in really, really bad quality. And we had an opportunity to do a new 4K scan from an original 16mm kinescope print. We took that scan, and my colleague Jack Beekston and his technical wizard associate Scott Jondro have a new technique they've developed where they're able to take that 16mm kinescope and make it look as if you were seeing it on live television when it went out in 1953. So the quality is incredible. And, you know, restoring something iconic like that with someone like Lugosi is tremendously exciting for us. And we went one step further and got Gary Rhodes, who's probably the world's foremost Lugosi scholar, to do a commentary track over it, talking about Lugosi and what he was doing in the summer of 1953 and tying in with his work with Ed Wood and Dolores Fuller. So there's a lot to take in, and I think people are going to really enjoy seeing that.
Well, I know I did. I haven't watched all the extras yet because, to be honest, it's a ton of extras, and I didn't want to Robot Monster myself out. You know, like, it's like you got to space it a little bit. And that was one, when I saw that, I was like, okay, this one's going to go with, and it was in the quicker to watch pile. You know, everybody always has to pick things. You don't, you're just looking at the titles, and as soon as you see Bela Lugosi, it's like, that moves up to near the top of the list. That kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
Now, but you also have a commentary track, you know, going on for so people. I know a lot of people like to get that get physical media love commentary tracks. Can you talk a little bit about who you have on this one?
Well, yeah, that's that was put together by a wonderful friend of ours, Eric Kurland of 3D Space, and Eric is joined by Greg Moffitt, of course, Mike Ballou, who's another dear friend, and Mike is currently writing what's going to be the definitive book on vintage 3D called Close Enough to Touch, 3D Comes to Hollywood. That book should be published sometime in 2024. But Mike's on the commentary, and then Lawrence Kaufman, another member of the LA 3D group, who's very knowledgeable and brings some interesting insights. So it's a fascinating commentary track, and basically gives you an opportunity to just join them in the room as they're watching the movie and hear their comments and observations.
You have me now wanting to add a book to my list for next year. You know, and I know a lot of people listening to this are going to be writing that book down again. Could you give the title of the book again for those that want to write it down?
Absolutely. It's going to be called Close Enough to Touch, 3D Comes to Hollywood. And Mike's been doing research on this book now for several years. And I got to tell you, he is coming up with so much new information. It boggles my mind. I mean, I've been doing research into this material for about 40 years. And Mike is finding all sorts of things I never knew about. It's going to be a remarkable book and really the definitive statement on Golden Age 3D movies. So anyone with an interest in that period and that technology, I think you're going to be very, very pleased with his book.
Now, you just brought up the phrasing Golden Age 3D movement. Could you, for listeners, can you give an idea of the time frame you're talking about when you're referring to the Golden Age?
I think it's mostly the 1950s, you know, because you're 3D movies go back to the 1920s, but they really kicked into high gear in 1951 and 52. So the Golden Age basically runs from that point to about the late 1960s, and then that would become the Silver Age, you know, the whole 70s and 80s 3D boom as well. So it kind of breaks it down a little bit into its different categories.
Now, for listeners to know, you had this set up so people can watch Robot Monster in a multitude of ways. So, you know, depending on what technology they have access to. So if you can just break down the different ways they can watch Robot Monster, so depending on what their technological setup is, they can go for it whichever way they fits best. Because I know my daughter, she hates 3D movies because they give her headaches. And I know some people are like that, where if they try to wear the glasses or whatever, it's just, you know, gives them headaches. So there are those people. So they'll be able to watch it in 2D. But I mean, besides 2D, what other aspects do you have?
Well, everything on the disc is available to watch flat. So that's not an obstacle at all. As far as 3D, there are two versions. There's the Blu-ray 3D format, if you have the proper player and either a display or projector or VR headset, which a lot of people are using now, you can watch it in full discrete polarized 3D, which is how the film was seen in 1953. If you don't have any of that special hardware, then it's available in the red and cyan anaglyphic 3D. And we include one pair of glasses in the disc, but there's also additional pairs available from, we recommend American Paper Optics because they have glasses made to spec on both the red and cyan filtering, and you get an optimum stereo image if you're using the American Paper Optics glasses. So yeah, there's three different ways to watch the film on the disc. So we've covered all of our bases.
And that's what I like, because sometimes in the recent years, you'd have people put out these 3Ds, but then you'd had to have the 3D Blu-ray with the 3D projector or TV or whatever, you know, something capable. And you're just like, oh, why couldn't you just put the, you know, have it the other way and have the glasses available so people can watch it with what they have? And I like it that you have the ability for people to, depending on what their capabilities are, they can do it any which way fits best for them.
Well, yeah, you mentioned headaches. You know, everybody's eyes are different. But a lot of people have a problem viewing vintage 3D because, let's face it, the older transfers and versions that were out there were not very good quality. And that's one thing that we do when we restore a film is we go shot by shot and correct any misalignment and are very careful with the left-right image panel matching for an optimum stereo image. So even if you've had a bad experience seeing vintage 3D in the past, you might be very pleasantly surprised to see the new restorations that we've done. Greg Kintz, our technical director, has developed a new encoding process for the anaglyphic conversion, which is vastly superior to what people had seen in the past. So, you know, it's really a whole new way to experience. For the most part, the 3D images that were captured in analog on film 70 years ago are a very high quality 3D image. We're delighted to have this opportunity now to present them in a way that honors the creative team and all the craftspeople that came together to capture and create those 3D images.
Well, I'm glad you do. And 3D Film Archives, this is not your only production. You know, it's not, you're not just, we did Robot Monster. As you mentioned, you've done other things before and after. What's a project or two that you've done before that you want to bring up? And then we'll talk about what you have coming out currently or soon.
Well, we've done over 30 features, but I've also have a long-standing association with the Abbott and Costello Estates. I was their official archivist for many years, and I co-wrote what many considered to be the definitive book on their movies called Abbott and Costello in Hollywood back in 1990. And I utilized that relationship to restore some Abbott and Costello films over the past couple of years. We have done restorations on Africa Screams and their first color movie, Jack and the Beanstalk. And those releases are loaded with a lot of bonus content as well. We've also restored the Abbott and Costello TV show, the iconic situation comedy that they did in the early 50s that inspired the Seinfeld, among many other shows. We're very proud of those, and we're just finishing up the restoration now on the second season of the Abbott and Costello show. That will be coming out possibly by the end of this year, but at the very latest, early next year, from Classic Flicks. So we're very happy to get that show restored and out there for fans of Abbott and Costello.
Well, I'm an Abbott and Costello fan, and I think not just of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, but I grew up watching on TV, you know, it'd be on Saturday or Sunday, you know, it almost, you know, especially if it's a rainy day and you weren't outside playing, it seemed like there was almost always an Abbott and Costello movie at least once a month, and you got to go through a whole bunch of them. So to know that there's certain things being out there that weren't in good, as good, in better quality condition now than I probably watched it when I was growing up, makes me, you know, looking forward to seeing them.
Well, we're really proud of Jack and the Beanstalk because that was their first color film. It was done in an unusual color process called Super Cine Color. The film went public domain in the late 1970s. So for decades, literally decades, there have been really bad, washed out color versions out there. It's a film that was very much desperately in need of restoration because the original Eastman color negative and color separation masters are long gone. But we were able to work from multiple 35 millimeter release prints and utilize some pretty advanced digital techniques to not only restore the film and the full color palette that it originally had, but get it looking as close as possible to what the original camera negative would have looked like a lot of people have been pretty blown away with the quality of Jack and the Beanstalk. So if you've only seen a bad copy of it, I very, very highly recommend the restoration that we have available from Classic Flicks. I think you'll be really surprised and very happy with it.
Oh, I think so too. And is there any other things you have working on that you want to talk about?
Well, yeah, we've got a lot of 3D irons in the fire. We've just finished restoring The Man Who Wasn't There, 1983 3D comedy, and that's going to be released by Kino Lorber later this year. We're wrapping up work on Bwana Devil, the Arch Obler feature, which was the first full-colored domestic 3D feature released in 1952. And that basically kick-started the short 3D boom of 1953. That will be coming out from Kino Lorber early in 2024. And we're getting the scans next week on Money from Home, which was a Technicolor 3D movie starring Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. And it was photographed with a very complex camera system called Dynoptic 3D, which utilized two interlocked three-strip Technicolor cameras. And it was a massive amount of scanning. And I have to give a shout out to the Paramount Pictures Archive, specifically Andrea Collis and Charlotte Barker, because they have scanned 72 reels of Technicolor camera negative for this restoration. It's about 54,000 feet of film in 4K resolution. And we're going to be starting to work on that in about 2 weeks. We're expecting the drives next week. We're really anxious to dive into that because it's going to be probably one of the best looking vintage 3D films on Blu-ray when our work is done. And it's a lot of fun. It's a Martin and Lewis comedy. I was friends with Jerry Lewis for a lot of years. And for me, this is personally a very gratifying project to restore his only 3D movie. So that will be coming out in 2024 for the 70th anniversary. I think people are going to really enjoy that one as well.
Now, for listeners that want to know where you're going to be coming up, what's coming out later down the road and down in the future, because obviously you only talked about what might be coming out this later this year or next year, where can they follow to make sure they know what's happening with 3D Film Archives?
We are most active on our Facebook and Instagram accounts, and that's a good way to follow us. Our website is also a great way to keep up to date. Anytime that we have a new release, it will be added to the available film restorations page on the website. Those are really the three best places to keep track of what we're doing. And, you know, we've got so much on the plate now that we don't have an awful lot of time to be active on social media. But I think if you could follow us on one of those three locations, you'll be getting all the information about upcoming projects.
And listeners, again, go to Monster Bash this October 13th through the 15th, 2023 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. On October 14th, the Saturday, you'll be able to see the restored version of Robot Monster in its glory in 3D with the glasses, introduced by Bob, followed by a Q&A with Bob and Gregory Moffat. And Gregory Moffat and Bob will be there all 3 days. You can go to Greg and get your picture with him, autographs like we talked about before. And if you want to learn more about Greg, you can go to the episode right prior to this. I have an interview with him. And I'm sure Bob will be hanging around Greg's table as he's taking in his first Monster Bash and having fun with the people he's coming out with.
Yeah, I think, in fact, I believe we're going to have a table next to Greg's. I won't be there until Saturday, but I'll definitely, you know, set aside some time to be at the table and meet people, take any questions they may have. I'll have some merchandise there. We'll definitely have the Robot Monster disc. I'm going to try to have a couple of the Abbott and Costello discs with us as well. But more than anything else, just a chance to meet people and say hello and interact with people that have an interest in film restoration and like what we do. And I'm really looking forward to it. So, Stephen, I had a great time. I appreciate the opportunity to join you. You had some really, really interesting and fun questions. So thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Oh, you're welcome. And thank you for taking time to join me. And thank you for doing the restorations of movies like Robot Monster and a lot of the other ones you brought up. And there's many more he didn't mention, which you can ask him about at the convention. But thank you for taking time. And I'm looking forward to meeting you in October.
Likewise, Stephen. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Hope everybody enjoyed that episode. And again, Bob, thanks again for joining me to talk about Robot Monster and your other restoration projects that you're working on. I'm looking forward to seeing you at Monster Bash. And for those that want to leave us feedback on this episode, feel free to email us at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com or leave us a message on our Facebook page. Otherwise, I hope everybody's having a good day. I want to thank everybody for listening. And you're going to listen to the promo for Monster Bash that's coming up this October to end the episode. So hope to see everybody there. And our next episode, for those wondering, is going to be Xandor Vorkoff, who's going to be another guest at Monster Bash. So hope everybody listens for that episode too.
Here comes Monster Bash to the Marriott Pittsburgh North this October 13th, 14th, and 15th. Guest movie and TV stars signing autographs, 150 vendor tables of cool, new, and vintage Monster movie merchandise, toys, model kits, Monster magazines, comics, DVDs, Blu-rays, VHS tapes, T-shirts, and so much more. Guest stars signing autographs include Greg Moffitt from the low-budget classic Robot Monster, The Adventures of Superman, Science Fiction Theater, and more. Linda Miller, the star of King Kong Escapes, and featured in the cult classic film The Green Slime. Carl Craig, child star of the Gamera Japanese Giant Monster Fest, Destroy All Planets. Tony Isabella, iconic Marvel Comics writer and editor, known for Dracula Lives, Ghost Rider, The Amazing Spider-Man, Tales of the Zombie, and more. Xander Vorkov, star of Dracula vs. Frankenstein, will be bashing
the 1970s Dracula.
TV horror host favorites, Ohio TV legend Son of Ghoul, plus Drac and Countess Carita. Meet them all, see special events, talks, and shop wall-to-wall monster movie collectible vendors. Admission is $25 a day or $60 for the whole weekend of entertainment. Discounts available in advance online at monsterbash.us or creepyclassics.com. It's Monster Bash, October 13th through the 15th, 2023, at the Pittsburgh Marriott North in Cranberry Township, Pennsylvania. Don't scare miss it.